LCDE being the exception to the rule, DFA is still like a day-to-day indie label, in a time when people are not buying records. James Murphy. Jonathan is pissed. Jonathan Galkin. The first person to ever break the story of Tim leaving DFA was resident advisor. Todd Burns was at that time the editor-in-chief, and I'd gotten totally drunk in Berlin, and I told him everything. He asked, "Can I write about this?" I said, "I don't give a shit. Just fucking let it out of the bag." That day, Tim called me and left a voicemail on my phone saying, "How could you guys do this?" That was the last time I ever heard from him. Tyler Brody.
But we still didn't know where he was.
Jonathan Galkin. I heard from a friend who said, "Hey, I read you guys are having a breakup with Tim Goldsworthy, and I heard you guys were trying to find him. He's actually producing the band my friend manages on Secretly Canadian, and they're working in a studio in Michigan. We served him on the very last day of recording. I was very polite. I did not interrupt their recording process, as I didn't want to fuck up the band. I got an email from the processor. At 2:34 p.m. this afternoon, Tim Goldsworthy was served, and I was just thrilled. We got him. As soon as the paperwork was filed, some court reporter who has his ear to the streets or might be a fan of LCD saw the name in the report and he broke the news. Within 24 hours, Pitchfork and everyone else had picked it up."
Jen Goldsworthy. Galkin leaked the news. Why would it have reached all these press outlets if someone hadn't leaked it?
Jonathan Galkin. The deal was, look, we're going to either come after you for all this money and for all the shit we think you stole, and we will go to the mat trying to prove it, or go away. Literally, walk away. Just walk away. We owe you nothing. You owe us nothing. Goodbye. Tim Goldsworthy. They wanted to write me out of everything. They wanted me to give up not only the writing and my credits on LCD, but everything on DFA. James had already started saying in interviews when speaking of me that I was not his partner in DFA, but the programmer for David Holmes, who they met at Plantain.
Jen Goldsworthy. It was very traumatic for us, just getting over the shock of the latter part of our lives in New York City. We were really taken advantage of. We lost all these friends. We had no money while raising a family of two young children. It was just horrendous.
Marcus Lamkin. Tim and Jen. They feed each other's little stories. "I'm fucking you over," when James has no intention of fucking anyone over. He said to me he really missed Tim, that he would never have anyone else that he can talk to about music in the same way. James Murphy. He feels slighted? Slighted by who? The outside world is out of our control. I never said DFA ain't Tim. I've said the opposite.
Jen Goldsworthy. We'd been so oppressed for so long, like, seriously. There are moments where it was like, is this really happening to us?
James Murphy. I'm just dying to find out what I did wrong. Chapter 84. When my mojo phase has passed, I don't think that I'll stop making music and start gardening.
Kim Taylor Bennett. Our Love to Admire, Interpol's third album, came out on Capitol. That was a surprise for people. They were intrinsically identified with Matador. They started to feel a bit far away. Here they were, this major label band, playing these big tours. I remember the reviews for that record were just okay.
Sam Fogarino. Critically, we started to lose a little ground. But where we were playing in front of 2,500 people before, now it was 7,000 people. We were playing small arenas in Paris and in Amsterdam and in Brussels. That really soothed the blow in terms of what we put each other through. I mean, we played Madison Square Garden on that tour. Daniel Kessler. That was a lot of fun. Sam Fogarino. But after that tour, we needed, and we took, a very long break. Paul Banks. I went through a phase where I lived in New Jersey, and I didn't have a social life. I just worked. I totally isolated on purpose for 3 years, and I liked it. But I did eventually realize that I'm one of those personality types that can go too far that way. I could go all Howard Hughes. I did my solo record when I was living out in New Jersey. Sam Fogarino. I'd had enough of certain aspects of the city, like the high cost of living and no space. I'd been coming down to Athens, Georgia for a couple years, and realized that I liked it, knowing that I'm never going to get rid of New York, and New York's never going to get rid of me. It's kind of a failsafe. You know what I mean? I get my fill on both sides. Paul Banks. I'm not the songwriter of Interpol. I'm not the dictator or the director of those songs. I'm the guy that writes the vocals and some guitar parts. But I don't define the textures or the tones, or introduce the progressions that become Interpol songs. That's Daniel. And I need an outlet where I do that. If Daniel didn't impress me so much with his songwriting, then I would just go do my own shit all the time.
Jenny Penny. Carlos hated being on tour. When we were on tour, it was super fun, but the next day he'd have a panic attack about something. We weren't together anymore, but when I heard he quit, I was like, that's awesome, he's going to be so happy. Because he loves New York, and he loves being here.
Paul Banks. There was a lot of tension, especially in the age of Carlos. Sam Fogarino. If it was something that he did, Carlos thought it should be heard. Paul Banks. I mean, I love Carlos. I really am deeply fond of that guy. We had an interesting relationship. I think he would absolutely disagree, but I believe that I know him fairly deeply.
Jenny Penny. They were really close. Closer than the rest of the guys.
Sam Fogarino. It just increasingly got worse. Paul Banks. When we started off, I used to be very frustrated because he had that extremely pretentious affectation all the time. Everything was very, very serious and rigid. I could play along, fire back, or be sarcastic with him, however, because I thought he can't be serious. He's not really that pretentious. But I think at a certain point I realized that, nah, he wasn't really kidding. After that, we started seeing each other differently. Sam Fogarino. He was conflicted. And then there was one day when he walked into the room and said, I'm really leaving the band. And that was that. I gave him a hug, and that was the last time I saw him.
Karen Ruttner. Carlos fully dropped out. He's a theater dude now.
Sam Fogarino. Which makes sense. He fancied himself a composer. On his website, there was a picture with him in a cardigan sweater and his dogs. He started going to acting school while we were making the fourth record. In hindsight, that's what it was. He did kind of play a role, and then he was done. And that's fair. When you're done, and good luck to you. The timing wasn't so good, but ultimately that was a great thing, because we weren't done with being a rock band. Paul Banks. If you're in the professional world and you start showing up acting all fucked up at the office, you get fired. If you're in a rock band, no one fires you. No one says, dude, you're being a jackass, go talk to HR and pack up your desk. In the rock world, you can be a big fucking mental case all day, every day, and that's fine. Of course, I'm not speaking about my bandmates or myself, God forbid. But that's why it's so volatile and hard to keep bands together. But they do stay together if they can just keep in mind that they're in a very privileged position. Ultimately, what's important is we are all aware it's a miracle that we found each other in the first place, that we're able to write songs together. We are more than the sum of our parts, and that's magic. Sam Fogarino. Well, here's another cliche. All the great staff that signed us to Capitol, that signed Radiohead, they all got fired. They'd been there for ages and courted us for 5 years. And literally, as soon as we press record on the tape machine, they're gone. So midway through the Our Love album cycle, we had nobody there. The record still sold well, relative to the climate of the industry. Our touring excelled and increased. And all this in defiance of not having any champion at the record label. But by the time we were meant to deliver a second record to Capitol, we kind of just agreed to shake hands and not do it. Then we went back to Matador. It took a minute. Daniel Kessler. We were always clearly more of an indie band than a major label band. So we tried seeing what it would be like to be on a major label. We tried it. We saw what it was all about. Sam Fogarino. Were there any sort of, like, pouty girlfriend moments with Matador? Yeah. Because while they are great business people, we were friends. They were hurt. And then maybe a few months later, when everything was sorted, the record was going to come out on Matador. I remember talking to Nils Bernstein and saying it felt like we didn't even leave. It was such a blip in time. And now there's no turning back. Paul Banks. If someone like me thinks, what if I'd just done my own thing from the get-go? What if I'd made the wrong decision about being in a band? What I always have available and accessible is, yeah, but the fans can't all be wrong. Man, are we lucky that these people want to come and see us. That's what reminds me, no, this is worthwhile. Because all these people believe in what we do. That's always a very grounding thing. Fans don't fuck around. Daniel Kessler. We do have fun. Paul Banks. Having outside interests helps. Now I paint and surf. I just paint realism. I just do portraiture. It's just reproductions. My dad asked me, so do you plan on doing anything original? And I was like, nope. I'm not trying to make any statement with painting. I just like to paint. Daniel Kessler. We're all really private, and we're need time alone people. Paul Banks. For me, making music is a bit like a biological function. It's a reaction to my daily life. Life made me need to express myself through music, and I have not suddenly become very satisfied with life, or the human condition isn't all of a sudden cool by me. It's a fairly self-sustaining system. You have to learn how to protect yourself. Don't read anything about yourself. Don't take anything too seriously. Just do what you want to do. And know that the real lucky thing is that you have something you really want to do. I do also believe that if, say, I had a family and I wanted to cool down, I would still write music. I think we're safe that even if society does evolve and we become a good species, I don't think that'll be at the expense of art. When I'm an old fucking dude, when my mojo phase has passed, I don't think that I'll stop making music and start gardening. Daniel Kessler. The fact that we've done all these tours, put out all these records, played and had people actually want to hear our music, seen all these places throughout the world, of course it's tiring and taxing, but I don't forget that it's amazing. This is all I ever wanted to be doing. That's the bottom line. That's the bottom line. I wanted to do this. And it almost didn't happen. But then it did. That never gets old. Paul Banks. Back when we were touring Our Love to Admire and starting to see the next generation of bands coming up, that was an interesting vibe. You're starting to feel, oh wait, to them we're an established band. That's a weird thing. Like now to college kids, we're old people. How the fuck did that happen? I don't feel like I look that different, but apparently I'm an old guy now. You know, I'm the guy trying to pick up 18-year-olds. Hey kids, want some reefer? Just kidding. Peter Kadis. People do not understand Paul's sense of humor. He's a really funny guy. Paul Banks. There's that point where you become Kevin Costner and Bull Durham. You go from Tim Robbins, all the raw potential in the world, but you're just being a fucking idiot. And then you get older, and there's this respect from people, not necessarily because they love your record, but because they're like, yo, that's their fourth record and they're still here. I like the feeling of, oh shit man, in some contexts, we're established now. That's one of the perks of getting older. It's like, oh, I guess I do know some shit. I've managed to not OD or break up this band. Chapter 85. We warmed it up for you fuckers.
Karen O. Fuck, man. Modern times. It's so complicated. I do remember being really genuinely excited and feeling like it was a moment. Like we were part of a real moment. But nobody will let you enjoy that. None of the bands, none of the press. It was still postmodern type bullshit where it was like, always question it, always be suspicious of it, never take it at face value. So here we were in a real fucking moment, which hadn't happened for New York since the late 70s, early 80s. And everyone kept referencing that other time. You're just like, shut up. Everyone kept questioning it, like, is this real or is it just hyped up to be real? But it was real. And I had a hard time just embracing it completely and being able to fully enjoy it because I was suspicious. The cynicism about it and the questioning of it really got under my skin. I remember one time at this vintage store in Cleveland. I picked up an old copy of New York Rocker, which was a music publication, but, you know, one that was on newsprint. I still have it. It was from when that was happening. Blondie on the cover and, what's his name, fucking blank generation, Richard Hell, and the Ramones. It was the Year in Review issue, and it was the same fucking shit. There was a real cynicism about it, like, were these people for real? Questioning the authenticity of it all. When you think about it, that's so crazy. People to this day think of that era as one of the most authentic moments in rock history. So seeing that did make me feel better, but it was almost too late. I mean, we were still pretty good at enjoying ourselves, don't worry, but it was more like, how seriously do we take the collective experience? How seriously to take this as a moment, a real moment that's happening to us and all these other bands in the same city? We were swept up in it, but we also questioned how authentic it was because everyone else was questioning it. And that's a shame, because there hasn't been a moment like that since. And there might not be for a long time.
James Murphy. Scene was never a dirty word. Scene was a good word pre-hipster. A scene was what you were proud of. We were trying to build a scene. At the same time, we were myth-building. We were scene-building. Now it seems grotesque. But before universal hipsterism, that was what you were proud of, where you were from, your family. As a kid, you were defined by what you listened to. These days, everyone strives to be the surprise. But everyone is striving to be the surprise in the exact same way. Oh, you have a unicycle and antlers and a wax recorder? Surprise!
April Long. All of the things that would go on to be cycled through Brooklyn in the following 10 years, from trucker hats to mason jars to home-brewed beer, all of the stuff that has become cliché Brooklyn, did start with music, more or less. Alex Wagner. The music being made by the earlier bands, it wasn't sustainable. Can you keep those emotions and that kind of process going for the long run? The answer is no. Julian Casablancas lives in the country now, and Albert Hammond is making music that is inheriting, you know, the mantle of Grizzly Bear and Vampire Weekend. I am not putting value on either one, but what is being made by those bigger kind of quote-unquote Brooklyn bands is a much more sustainable and exportable form of New York.
Rostam Batmanghelish. There were no leaders of the Brooklyn scene, and aesthetically, we were all in our own world. That's less true about the early 2000s. The Strokes, the Walkmen, Yeah Yeah Yeahs, Interpol. Aesthetically, they were way more united than Yeasayer and Vampire Weekend. Ezra Koenig. I always hated our association with Brooklyn, and I've lived in Brooklyn, and it's a beautiful place, and I have nothing against it. But I always felt, it just felt so untrue to me. That Brooklyn aesthetic, to me, had nothing to do with our thing. And in fact, that Brooklyn aesthetic drags ours down a little bit, if we associate too closely with it. I really felt, if anything, Vampire Weekend was the Manhattan branch of a little New England burgeoning scene. Andy Greenwald. When I interviewed Vampire Weekend, they didn't even live in Brooklyn. That was the thing that I kept having to pretend was true, exactly. When I interviewed Ezra, he lived in Manhattan. Matt Berninger. Williamsburg was the flagship neighborhood. Brooklyn and Williamsburg and New York all became the same thing on a world level, on an international level. Nick Offer. One time, halfway through an interview, the lady said, "Wait, where's Karen?" And it was like, "Yeah, we're Chick Chick Chick. Karen's not in this band." Another time, a different woman was like, "So you recorded a song called North American Scum." And we were like, "Actually, we didn't." And then later in the same interview, she goes, "So you did this song for Nike." And I was like, "No, we didn't. It's superficial. What they know is, band from New York." Matt Berninger. It wasn't the Nationalists coming to Germany. It was Brooklyn is coming to Germany. Imran Ahmed. The rise of these bands coincided with a rebranding of New York, and the New Yorkification of the world. You could argue that London has more in common with New York these days than Newcastle. Tokyo has more in common with New York than Osaka. Tunde Edebimpe. I was talking to somebody about another project I have. And just to get us a little publicity, my friend Jenny got us a Rolling Stone interview. I just wanted to talk about the project and the band and the video I animated for it. But at one point I mentioned that I was moving to L.A., and a journalist asked, "Oh, why are you moving to L.A.?" "Oh, I've got a gig, and New York will be here when I get back." The title of the article was not about the band when it came out. It is Tunde Bails on Brooklyn, opens up about moving to L.A. And I was just like, what the fuck? And it also described me as a pillar of Brooklyn hipsterdom. I wish I had known I was a pillar of Brooklyn. I would have abused that so much more. Why did I just find out about this now? I could have gotten away with so much shit. And now it's over. Dave Siddick. I still don't have perspective. Everyone reading this has more perspective on what happened in New York. My perspective was, oh yeah. And then I replaced that tape machine. Jaleel Bunton. What's so funny is that we started playing in 2003, and we started touring right away. So this whole thing about representing Brooklyn in New York, we weren't even fucking here. It wasn't until 10 years later that I was like, what the fuck happened to this place, man? Like, I just got off the bus and this shit is totally different. It's very surreal to miss this whole evolution. It's your fault, and you don't even live here.
April Long. I mean, when exactly did Brooklyn?
Sarush Alvi. Get boring and shitty?
Eleanor Friedberger. At some point, and I'm not sure when, it became cool to be rich.
Sarush Alvi. There was the building boom. 2007 feels like it was a big turning point. And I don't know specifically, but I do know that whenever that building boom happened, it changed the vibe, the aesthetic, the landscape, how everything felt in the neighborhood. Somehow, boom, the buildings were all full.
Eleanor Friedberger. When did rich become cool? I feel like when I got home around 2007, we would walk around just thinking, what the fuck? Seeing somebody's car or seeing people sitting outside drinking wine at a restaurant. I don't remember one single instance, but it was just a general lifestyle shift. And then part of what was dark about it was I was seduced by it. In my own way, I started being seduced by it. I wanted those status symbol things. There was a woman who worked for Prada or Miu Miu, and she was a big Franz Ferdinand fan. Alex Capranos was my boyfriend at the time, and we were living in this house he bought in Greenpoint. It was her idea to get us to model together in a campaign, and he said no, but my name was still in the pool for some reason, so I got to do it with these other girls. Franz Ferdinand were given, like, a gazillion dollars. I can't even think of how much money they were given in merchandise. So much shit. And all the guys had girlfriends and wives, and I just remember feeling like, I want that. I wanted shit I never wanted before. And we would get into, like, weird fights. It was horrible. It was so stupid. Like, I want that coat. It was fucked up.
Matt Berninger. It was like the gold rush in the cool zone. Everybody wanted to move here. Everybody, every band wanted a little shop or something to do with Brooklyn, you know? Ultimately, that all comes down to marketing and the real estate moguls who know how to make it all sound sexy. Sarush Alvi. It was a fucking super sudden, instantaneous, incredibly aggressive expansion in the neighborhood that permanently changed the vibe of Williamsburg. But not for a bad thing. Matt Berninger. Brooklyn just became the surrogate New York City. And New York City is the center of the universe and culture, the way Rome was at some point. The city in the 90s and early 2000s was Rome. It was the coolest place. I loved it. I'd be miserable. I'd be heartbroken. I'd be just bored, depressed, totally broke. But it was like, I'm here. I'm in the movie. I'm in New York City? I'm not in Cincinnati. I mean, it was dead chickens and burning cars and double-ended dildos and rotten milk outside my door every day. But it was New York, even though it was Brooklyn. Sarush Alvi. Look, we came out here because we were poor and couldn't afford not to come. And now Vice employees are moving to Manhattan because it's cheaper to live there than in Williamsburg. Things shift. Alex Kapranos. When Eleanor and I lived in Greenpoint, we'd go into Manhattan on our bikes. We'd circle back, and on our way, I'd always want to cycle down Bedford just to gawk at people. I used to love that, like, look at that. But she wouldn't do it. We started these huge fights. She wouldn't want to go anywhere near them, whereas I used to just love it. It was like going to the zoo.
Eleanor Friedberger. The reason why I didn't like riding down Bedford is that there were a lot of people, and I didn't want to ride my bike with all the distraction. I just wanted to get to where I was going. Alex liked it because he liked to gawk and look around at everything, and that annoyed me. He was really into New York because he felt like there was a scene there, and he really wanted to hang out with other musicians. Eventually, I realized, I really am part of this amazing community. I know so many musicians, especially in this one part of Brooklyn, and I love walking down the street saying hey. I didn't appreciate it until then. It was immaturity on my part. And I also had all the classic complaints about gentrification, which are, of course, legitimate.
Imran Ahmed. The reinvention of New York as the world's aspirational brand absolutely happened. People around the world were looking to New York for how they should live their lives. Andy Greenwald. We have exported this idea, and it's our number one export to the world to this day. Last summer I was in Paris. I got there and I was jet-lagged, walking around at dusk, and it was beautiful and summer, and I couldn't believe where I was. It was very disorienting. I look across like a beautiful archway, and there's a restaurant that looks amazing, with natural wood and a line out front. I think, holy shit, this must be the spot. This must be the new bistro cuisine being invented in Paris. And I get closer, and I see crowded tables, and there's something on every table. I get closer and closer, and I realize there are bottles of ketchup on every table because it's a burger place, and it looks like Momofuku. And there's a clothing store nearby that just sells everything that Stephen Allen sells. And I couldn't tell you the place in Brooklyn that looks like any of this, but it's the sweaters and the artisanal hamburgers and the soundtrack, and that has absolutely gone around the world. And it has nothing to do with Brooklyn itself anymore. It's an idea. And it was always an idea. James Murphy. I want to be pro-Brooklyn. I don't want to be grumpy. I don't want to be that guy. Jaleel Bunton. I'm trying to think about what to say without sounding like a bitter fucking snob. Tunde Edebimpe. At some point along the way, I started taking every show poster or flyer from where we and our friends played. So now I have a ton of these. A friend recently said, "You should really put those together into a book." And I said, "Yeah, it should be like a Toshin-style book. Really fancy, with all these posters and a little writing, and we should call it We Warmed It Up for You Fuckers." On the front, it should be a close-up of a woman in a pink bathrobe with a shot from the Maps video. She would be on her computer holding her cell phone and doing her nails, and watching the laptop on her lap. And it would be like an Edward Hopper painting, but there would be a shot from girls on the laptop. That will be the cover. I think it will happen. Put a little something in the tip jar. Dave Siddick. You can look at it in the sense that Brooklyn's gotten smaller. Brooklyn is happening anywhere. You can look at any city from Baltimore to St. Louis in the same trajectory. Clean up downtown and push the people out. I think that there's great music happening all over the world. I wish that NYC still had the potential that it had for us, for kids who are moving there now, that they could be as reckless and carefree as we were. But maybe they're not supposed to be. Maybe they're supposed to do it in Austin or Detroit. There are so many cities that you go to now, and you're just surprised, like, oh wow, it's happening in Arkansas? That's the best part about it. It's not supposed to stay in NYC. Part 5. New York, I love you, but you're bringing me down. Chapter 86. I mean, what's more rock and roll than Madison Square Garden and a mic drop? Phil Mossman. There's nothing wishy-washy with James. He has epiphanies on accident, and they're very clear, obvious things, but quite amazing, really. He said to me, "I woke up in the middle of the night, and I have an idea for the second record. It has to be better than the first one." Totally simplistic, but he actualized it. Sound of Silver was huge. James Murphy. The end of Decade Polls in 2010 changed everything. Sound of Silver had done well. People liked it. Mark Ronson. The DFA stuff was exciting, but it wasn't until the second album that I absolutely fell in love with LCD. Thomas Honorato. I have this really clear memory of getting a root canal, sitting there, and the dentist is doing the root canal, and I'm listening to the music he's playing on his iPod, and New York, I Love You, But You're Bringing Me Down comes on. He has Hair, the musical, and then LCD Sound System. James Murphy. After the polls came out, and we were so high on the decade's best of with Sound of Silver, we got this second lift. I'd taken a year off. My marriage was hard, and my life was crazy, and I needed to breathe. The polls came out, and I went to record another record. And that was the first time I made a record with expectation. It was a fuck you to everybody. Interpol, Bloc Party, all the bands that were bigger than us, British Sea Power, everybody who was above us at festivals. Bands that were so nice to us. Have a great show. Yeah, we're going to fucking bury you. Jonathan Galkin. He had this tour booked for the third record, for This Is Happening. Madison Square Garden was something that was just on the calendar. You know, instead of doing 3 nights at Terminal 5, we'll do 1 night at Madison Square Garden. The venue's open, and it routes perfectly here. Suddenly, it was just on the calendar. Phil Mossman. It was the same thing with the final show. He just called me and said, "We'll just end it with a big party. Like a definitive big celebration. No drama, and it's done." It was very James. Jonathan Galkin. I just remember, within a certain amount of time after seeing MSG on his routing sheet, he said, "Did I tell you? I think it's going to be the final show." That's pretty much how it happened. You know what? Let's just end it there. It's almost like he backed himself into the myth. I mean, what's more rock and roll than Madison Square Garden and a mic drop? James Murphy. I knew it was the last record. I just felt three and out. With punk bands, the first three are good, and the rest suck. Did I think I'd start to suck? I'm not in charge of that. I was thinking about Little Creatures by Talking Heads. That's their biggest record, and I don't like that record. And that's a band I love. What would be the point of continuing? I like to fight. I'm an underdog by nature, and I like to be fighting. I don't make music for myself. I make music to fight. Tim Goldsworthy. Fucking hell, they played Madison Square Garden, and the Strokes played the same place the next night. Chapter 87. The Last Rock Stars.
Laura Young. The Strokes are one of those bands that other bands are going to reference for the rest of rock and roll.
James Murphy. After MSG was booked, but before it was announced, we were arguing with the promoters about who was going to play with us. They were concerned it wasn't going to sell out. They said, how about Big Boy from Outkast? Why the fuck would Big Boy play with us? I mean, they had no faith in us. So I said, fuck it. It's our last show. Give me another date. We'll sell it out in 2 weeks. I want a second date. I asked for a second date, and the Strokes already had it.
Laura Young. To me, the Strokes' first album is one of the greatest albums that will ever be, so they've got that going for them. But they represent such a moment in time that sometimes it's hard to break out of unless you really reinvent yourself. I mean, unless you're the Beatles and you make Sgt. Pepper, you're not going to break out of that mold of, oh, this is that band that came out of the early 2000s and defined a moment. Nothing they do will ever be as cool as that first album.
Chris Taylor. I still listen to Is This It? I'll go to the gym and put that on, as 30-something as that sounds. But fucking hell, it's so good. Adam Green. I saw them play that Madison Square Garden show.
Laura Young. I was there. I had seats, but I traded with somebody so I could be in the pit. I thought, I know I'm a little bit too old for this, but I'm going anyway. I remember seeing these kids that were 15 years old. I was either talking to them or overhearing them, and they were saying, this is the first time I'm seeing the Strokes. I listened to them all through elementary school and middle school. It was so cool to see them there and so excited. I don't know, maybe somewhere, somehow, years from now, Vampire Weekend will do some kind of a reunion show, but I can't imagine young kids being there saying, I love Vampire Weekend so much, I'm so excited about them. I've been listening to them since elementary school. And if they are, they should be punched in the face.
Albert Hammond Jr. We're all 6 feet tall plus, and I think people don't know that. So when we walk in the room, it's five guys, we're all really tall and all kind of nervous. And Julian had a look of not giving a shit, which is awesome when you're young. I'm not saying any of this is something we thought of. I'm just saying when I look back and see pictures of us, I feel that energy. I was one of them, and I look back and say, I want to be one of them.
Kimya Dawson. I'll be walking into a store somewhere random and one of their songs will come on overhead and it paralyzes me. I get choked up thinking about those guys and how awesome they were and how fun they were to be around. They were our good friends and they busted ass and they took care of us.
Chris Thompson. I feel a little bit bad for the Strokes at this point because they signed at the tail end of a certain system of doing things. And we signed during what was, not the beginning, but a kind of nascent time, a time of something new. Albert Hammond Jr. There was this amazing time. Before we had to record the first record, we'd play to 80 people or something like that, but no one really knew us. We could just walk around town and think, I'm in this band. We can bring people to shows. And that was by far the best time. Everything was so innocent. Somehow you lose the innocence through time and through doing too much. Then you spend a lot of time chasing that same innocence.
Karen Ruttner. I didn't like them, but even I can see they were a much bigger cultural phenomenon than any of those other bands ever were.
James Murphy. I did say The Strokes was my record of the decade. Is this it? Whenever people were poo-pooing that record, I was like, you're saying that now. But I guarantee you, you're going to have a barbecue in 10 years. Play that shit and say, I love this record. Sarush Alvi. For all the talk about The Strokes, how they fucked it up, that their records suck now, there is still no one cooler. They are still the last imprint of that particular brand of rock cool. They're the last real rock stars. And live, they're still so spectacular. They don't do anything. They just stand up there and kill it. I saw them at Coachella right before that MSG show. And Julian was like, I just flew in. I don't know what the fuck is going on. I just got on my gold-plated jet. Such a bored rock star. And then he gets on stage and didn't do anything but kill it.
We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of Meet Me in the Bathroom, Rebirth and Rock and Roll in New York City 2001 to 2011 by Lizzie Goodman. Read by Charlie Thurston and Nicole Zanzarella. This program was produced by Dion Audio Services. Executive producer, Katie Ostroka. Text copyright 2017 by Elizabeth Goodman. Production copyright 2017 by HarperCollins Publishers. All rights reserved. Thank you for listening.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.